My wife Anne and I are both writers. For the record, neither of us write much haiku, but the writing that each of us does is very different. So I was interested when I heard about Naeem Murr and his wife Averil Kurdi. Naeem is a novelist. Averil is a poet. When the Poetry Foundation in Chicago commissioned a story from him about what it's like to be married to a poet, he welcomed the challenge.
I've never understood poetry. You see, I'm a fiction writer. If my poet ever appears in one of my books, she shall do so as a once beautiful, but now tragically disfigured nun.
So given that Naeem wrote this satirical and slightly antagonistic account of life with his poet wife, we thought it's only fair to hear the other side of the story from Averil Kurdi.
For now, I will consider my novelist. For at dawn's grumbling of the L in the east, he worships in his way. For this is done by grinding the beans and making me coffee. For in these few minutes, an elegantly fragrant silence reigns.
Loving my poet as I do, I try hard to understand what a poet is. The first clue lies in the fact that my poet, every poet, is an insomniac. A friend of mine, who's a literature professor, is very enamored of my poet, whom he describes tremblingly as the real thing. The real thing. He tells me he finds it profoundly reassuring that while we ordinary mortals are asleep, there exist lit rooms containing anxious, vigilant souls. A terrible responsibility, he says, devolves upon the poet that requires her never to be fully awake or asleep. The world will end, he once told me, when the final poet awake closes her eyes. Last night I woke up sweating, having dreamed of sinking with the rest of humanity into cold oblivion. Sure enough, my poet was fast asleep beside me, the first deep sleep she'd entered in more than a week. So I knocked a pile of books to the floor and returned to my blissful slumbers, much comforted by the thought that at least one poet would wander the midnight battlements, keep watch, and preserve us all for one more day.
My novelist's prompt and voluble good cheer in the morning strains my very last nerve. For doesn't he know we are all going to die? As he senses the magnanimous motions of his muse beginning within, my novelist burps. Now lightened in spirit, he scrawls on the door to his office, "Writer at work, no girls allowed." For he weeps for his characters, then pokes his head into my office, smiling to ask,
"You're not working, are you?" Having written 36 pages or so this morning, I take a break and seek out my poet. She's in the sitting room, leaning her forehead hopelessly against the window pane, staring into the street. "Finished any poems?"
"Not today."
"What, no signal again?" I make the call me gesture and wander around the sitting room, saying, "Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now?" She tells me quietly that if I don't leave her alone, she's going to disembowel me with her pencil. I lay low for a bit, and then very quietly carry my chair into the sitting room. She's still staring out of the window, unmoved. I get up onto the chair with my manuscript, which I lift as high as I can, before dropping. "Oh, I didn't mean to disturb you," I say. "Just wanted to get a sense of the heft of this new novel. It's a whopper."
Always he asks of each of my poems, "But what does it mean?" "For a poem should not mean but be," I intone. For he says, "Yes, be pretty." "No, for I like poems oblique as the reverse of antique tapestries and hard enough to crack a tooth on." For my novelist adds that he prefers poems with a good clear moral or a beautiful but disfigured nun and a bit of the old boom-chaka-boom-chaka-boom-boom-boom. Still gyrating his hips and giggling, he makes oatmeal for breakfast. For he writes only 50 pages before breakfast and so worries he's suffering writer's block, which he's pretty sure he caught from a toilet seat.
My poet actually did start to get the signal this morning and spent almost 6 hours scribbling in her notebook. The result? 10 lines on a single page. That page is now impaled upon her corkboard, trapped in a terrible limbo with her other poems in progress, some of them years old and countless drafts thick. I find her reading in her office and ask what her new poem is about.
That starling we saw, the one trapped in the Amtrak station.
And?
And that's what it's about.
So a tale of triumph, little guy against the corporate machine.
No, via negativa, apophasis. I'm thinking of what it's not.
What is not?
What the starling is not.
She points at her corkboard.
Why don't you just read it?
I do. And for a moment I feel as if the top of my head has come off, immediately followed by the rather unpleasant sensation that someone's rattling a stick around in there. Whoa, I say. Deep. I pretend to stagger for a while under the weight of its profundity. Feeling I've done my duty, I ask if I can tell her the plot of my new novel.
If you must,
she says, with that expression of desperate eagerness very particular to her, and strangely reminiscent of most people's expressions when they're not very eager at all. A woman has two children, a boy and a girl. I start to cry, but hold off. And she dies from the cancer.
What kind of cancer?
Cancer of the left ventricle. The key to good fiction is being specific. And her son becomes a boxer because he's full of anger at God. And her daughter becomes a nun, chaste, but under her cassock.
Habit.
What?
Nuns wear habits.
Why are you saying things I can't understand? Anyway, her loveliness is wasted because her cassock catches fire and she becomes horribly disfigured.
Stop.
Mildly disfigured?
Just stop, please.
A small scar that's actually quite becoming?
This is exactly the same as your other novel.
I can see she's in pain. My plots always move her. I don't get why poems can't have such stirring plots. Her poem is about what a starling is not. It seems to me that in a way all poems are about what a starling is not. Where's the passion, the triumph, human will overcoming tragedy and breaching the indifferent, where disfigured nuns cast off their cassocks to bare their beauty, where boxers beat men to a bloody pulp and cry up to heaven, "Here, here, damn you, is the work of my hands!" A starling, I say.
A starling? Why don't I just pop them out, he wonders. For he writes the story, and I write the song of the story. Plot bores me. He can have it. For who wants to worry always about this and then that and then this, when we are all going to die?
I don't know if this is one of the reasons my professor friend calls her the real thing, but my poet loves words in a way that I feel is quite unhealthy and unnatural. She owns a dictionary decades old, and so large she uses a small buffet cart to wheel it around our apartment like some invalid relative. The secret to a poet's soul lies somewhere in the little cells of that dungeonish dictionary, in the slow languishing of those old, mad, forgotten words. It's also in the very particular kind of art she, and every poet, seems to love. Joseph Cornell. I guarantee you will not find a single poet who doesn't start rubbing herself against the furniture the minute you mention Cornell and his little boxes full of human residue, the pleasures of the miniature. One good thing, though, is that after we went to see the Cornell exhibit some years ago, I got the idea to give her, for her birthday, a tobacco box in which I glued lots of small objects, secret decoder rings, vintage bottle caps, my grandfather's glass eye. She gushed. Like a Cornell, I pointed out.
I love it because you made it.
It's just like a Cornell.
You usually just give me cash.
Isn't it exactly like a Cornell?
I love it. Thank you.
Since then, that's what I've given her for every present. Small things glued into boxes, shoe boxes, cereal boxes, bento boxes, Happy Meal boxes. She does seem a little less enthusiastic.
For he is my dream of an old house. In my dream, I have lived in this house for years. When I open a door I've never seen before and enter a room filled with comforts and curiosities, a fox's spine strung within a bell jar, a doll's head crowned by a hive of honeybees. For this is how it feels when I read my novelist's new book. For then my next poem, trembling now like the meniscus upon a glut cup, now full as a melting icicle's bleb showing the inverted world, my next poem will be an elegy, infused with beauty and sorrow and the awareness that we are all going to die. Just write it, he says, spill it out, as though a poem is ever just written. Why don't I just write it? Well, I'll tell you. Because I am the cavalry charge into the cannon's maw, the winning run thrown out at home, the heroic yet impotent gesture.
My poet is in the sitting room with her forehead pressed to the window again. It's actually been a good week for us. I sold my new novel after a bidding war for $11 million, and my poet had a poem taken by a well-known literary journal, which gave payment in the form of an origami swan made out of her recycled submission. But I've been feeling contrite. I forgot our anniversary in January. Quietly, I approach my poet, who is lost in thought. In truth, health, riches, and a vast readership are as nothing compared to this moment. My poet turning to me, her face dilating beautifully as she murmurs like an approaching revelation. Glaucus. But her face soon clouds. Whatever it was didn't take hold, and the abortive flush of it leaves her sad and drawn. This seems a good time to hand her my anniversary gift. I'm sorry it's late. As she unwraps it, I walk away.
What's this?
She calls after me. A Cornell, I say.
Did you make it?
Oh, no. That, I say, pointing back at her, at my genuine and indisputable poet. That is the real thing.
For it is Valentine's Day, and this morning a new poem, more visionary than Dante's Inferno, more definitive than the wasteland, seeps into every cell of my body when my novelist knocks on the door. With a rose in his mouth, undressed only in a ribbon, he asks,
"You weren't planning to work today, were you?"
Naeem Murr's novel is called The Perfect Man, and Averil Kurdi's poems have appeared in Poetry Magazine and the Paris Review. Portions of our piece originally appeared in a podcast from the Poetry Foundation. And our story was produced by Studio 360's Pike Malinowski. Do you happen to be an artist living with another artist? If so, tell us about your happy home and or your creative clashes at studio360.org. Coming up, she's turning 50 this year, but she really hasn't aged a bit.
In many ways, she actually hasn't aged incredibly well. She's kept her figure, first and foremost, and her hair and her makeup, and she doesn't look a day older.
We look at how and why Barbie became an American icon.
We used to have, like, a giant box of naked Barbie.
That's just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International, and WNYC. Stay with us.